Good afternoon, this is Gary Kavanagh, here today with my friend and colleague, Michael Dwyer. It is the 9th of December, it is a Monday. Today we are talking euthanasia and Jeremy Corbyn. That's two topic, not one we've put together for our own enjoyment.
Well, if not this Thursday, the results on Friday may show that Germany has been euthanized by the British people, but yes, indeed.
I really enjoy that awkward chuckle you do when you're not sure if you can laugh at something. Anyway, you may have noticed, if you've been paying attention to the Irish media recently, you may have noticed that there has not been an article on euthanasia recently. There has been a flurry of articles on euthanasia, most recently in the Irish Times, which ran a piece called "Euthanasia is Sometimes the Right Choice." So, Michael, this is something people have debated for years, but let's finally give an answer to this. Is euthanasia sometimes the right choice? Let's just finish the philosophical debate in roughly 15 minutes.
Well, this may take up to 20 to 25 minutes even, because, you know, we want to get it done properly so that nobody ever has to ask the question again. We can lodge this podcast with the Library of the Oireachtas, and then we can move on to other more difficult issues.
I'm not sure if it's worth that amount of time. It's not really an important question.
Life or death, it's only life or death. That's, yeah.
Who was it who said that suicide is the only important philosophical question?
Albert Camus.
Ah, yes. I thought, but the name entirely slipped. So, euthanasia is suicide?
Well, you see, the thing is, Gary, it's not suicide.
It's assisted suicide.
Yeah, but that's the bit that creates the problem. Although, I think, in a way, it's interesting that if we think about it as suicide. Now, we don't treat suicide as a crime anymore, but we have, I wouldn't say an obsession, but certainly we have, because of the increasing rates of suicides amongst young men, and now we're seeing also younger women getting involved in that horrible tragedy. We are constantly talking about suicide. We have a plethora of suicide charities across the country. Suicide days, suicide awareness, suicide walks. And yet, precisely the same people who are talking about the tragedy of suicide and how to avoid suicide, donating their time and their money to suicide awareness, are talking about state-legislated, assisted suicide. And just, I don't think this is the biggest point, or the most important point, but it does seem to me you're setting up a form of a national cognitive dissonance, where on one side we recognise that suicide is a tragedy, that suicide is never necessary. And that's the line. It has to be the line. Suicide is never good. Suicide is always a tragedy. Suicide is something we should always try and avoid. Suicide is never a rational act. If you want to get your GP involved, and maybe the National Health Service at some level, perhaps in a specialised clinic or hospital, and you want them to kill you in a prescribed fashion, described by law, then maybe, you know, we should say, yes, then that's okay. And that it's okay for people to help you do that. I think there's a real problem there. If you're going to be serious in the future about talking to people about suicide, and you want them to keep a straight face when you're giving them the lecture, well then I think you're setting up legally assisted suicide is a problem. But anyway, I suppose.
Yeah, it is a little bit of a problem though, isn't it? On one hand, you're sort of going to people and going, you know, you'd never kill yourself. It would be a tragedy. And then they look over at the automatic suicide boot. Like, what about those people? Those people don't matter.
Yeah, that's a whole different story.
That's a life not worth living. Unlike your life, which I'm telling you is worth living, even though you don't consider it is, and may want to use the suicide booth.
I think that we should make a distinction from the get-go between active and passive euthanasia. Because if and when this debate gets going, I am fairly sure that people who are proponents of euthanasia will try and conflate the two and make different arguments from one to the other.
Hmm.
Now, passive euthanasia, what has historically been described as passive euthanasia, is when somebody, what would be described in moral philosophy as being the constant use of extraordinary means to maintain life. And I would say that most people, most philosophical or religious traditions would say that there comes a point where natural processes should be allowed to take their course, where we don't have to constantly intervene to maintain life, where those interventions are what we call it, would be called extraordinary. And so in those cases, you can say we could, it's perfectly ethical to come to a decision to say to apply a DNR, a do not resuscitate. It's, you know, if people say, for example, somebody's in a vegetative coma, there's a difference between maybe using extraordinary means to try and to maintain that if they are constantly suffering in the coma, as I believe can happen. Say they may be suffering strokes or from seizures or something, and that if you don't intervene constantly, then these episodes will take them. But on the other hand, there's a difference between that and refusing to give food and water.
So there's a difference between giving a patient a button that will just give them an endless supply of opiate-based painkillers and holding the pillow over their face.
Well, there is. There's a difference between giving them an endless supply of opiate-based painkillers or just taking one single, very, very large syringe full of an opiate and just injecting it into their arm. Yes.
Because people are talking about this because Vicky Phelan has come out and said that the country should legalise assisted suicide in Ireland because it's an option she might want to consider, which seems selfish.
Yeah, but it's again the case that Vicky has, for whatever it is, become something of a rather heroic figure.
A living martyr.
And is therefore people that pay, particularly on issues like this, on health issues, pay particular attention. We value, shall we say, the direct experience and the ability to speak from that experience. So people listen. So
yeah, it's one of those interesting things in that on one level, euthanasia is, you could go, well, it's, you know, what's the argument? You wouldn't let a dog suffer like that.
Yes, that's exactly the argument.
And then you say, yes, so the immediate consequence of the legalization of euthanasia is arguably a drop in the level of human suffering. The follow-on consequences for that, though, in the countries that have legalized it, have been rather less positive, though. So here's two headlines from The Guardian, Michael.
Yeah.
And I picked The Guardian because The Guardian is, in general, you know, very much on the side that would see this as being something that should happen.
Well, it's progressive, yeah.
So here's two, and they both relate to the Netherlands. One is from July of last year. Doctor in Netherlands asked family to hold down euthanasia patient. Medic is under investigation after report finds drug was also slipped into the woman's drink. And that relates to a story in which a doctor asked the family of a woman with dementia to hold her down so she could be euthanized.
I remember that because, story. That was absolutely horrific.
She had signed a living will that said she wanted to be euthanized at a certain time. And then she got dementia, which meant she was no longer of sound mind, which meant she could no longer sign contracts, which meant, although the fact that she said she didn't want to die, she didn't have a sound mind because of the dementia, and so couldn't override her previous contractual obligations. And I must tell you, Michael, as a man who is really pro-business, even I will say there are times when contracts are invalidated. But here's the second headline, and this comes from August of this year.
Yeah.
Netherlands euthanasia case. Doctor acted with best intentions.
Best intentions.
Yep. The unnamed female doctor acted with the best intentions.
I would take it that if somebody is struggling desperately for life, that's a good indicator that they want to be alive. And that's kind of should be the default position of the doctor. that any indication of like that. I don't want to fall down that horrible rabbit hole when we come to talk about ethical issues. But there is something about the image of a doctor holding a pillow over a patient's face that brings me to another time and another place, and doctors' failure to respect their Hippocratic oath and that tradition of defending life. They're also, I mean, but these are the extreme examples. Listen, we know that law changes. The law will change the culture. It always does. Changes in laws change the culture. And that can be a positive thing, negative thing. I mean, positive, for example, we know in the, it was the Wolfenden Report. I think it was the Wolfenden Report. And then after, which was about the, or the Devlin Report, on the changes in the laws regarding legalization of homosexuality in the United Kingdom. That it was predicted and it happened that there was a marked change in the attitude towards the tolerance, public tolerance of gay men and women after it became, after homosexuality was legalized. Now, if we legalize this, it will change the context of the culture in which we act. Elderly relatives, elderly friends, and one of the constant worries that they experience is the sense of being a burden, of being, having finished their contribution, and now they are simply consuming, and that they feel. And they can often become depressed and worried about this. The problem with this is there is inevitably going to be a massive power imbalance in the relationship.
I think we have, with all the advantages of Ireland always being 20 years behind somewhere, we're going to have a great deal of data from the Netherlands and Belgium on this.
And we're going to see what the future will. I mean, look at in Belgium, I think in the Netherlands, certainly in Belgium, we now have the sight of young people with mental illness. And actually, can we not say euthanized? Can we just say killed? I don't want to, you know, just to.
Do you not like euphemisms? It's not even a euphemism, it's just a rebranding, I suppose.
Yeah, and also because let's be an etymological pedant about it. Eutanized from from being happy, you from like in Eumedon in Greek or Eumedia was the word. Anyway, a happy death. These are not happy deaths. This is killing. It's killing sick people and killing old people. And it may, with or without their at any one time, it may be with or without their volition. So you've got cases of young people, say, suffering from serious depression. And applying, yes, they apply. And they say, why? Well, I have a serious psychological condition that makes me want to die. Well, you know what, lads? That's not an atypical description of a suicidal ideation in a severely depressed person. In this case, rather than spending hours and hours desperately trying to talk them out as committing suicide, because they grow through the correct bureaucratic process, you're going to say, okay, listen, don't worry about that. You're a sick person. You're worried. It must be very anxious for you thinking how to kill yourself. We'll kill you for you. Don't worry. I mean, this is... There's a dissonance about this, which is great. And what message is that sending out implicitly? Because what they're doing, historically, this was always, euthanasia was the last response to an irredeemable situation where somebody was in a terrible suffering at the end of their life. Now, a 29-30-year-old with severe depression, and we say, okay, it's okay to kill you. Is that basically the medical and word saying this is it?
Wait, do you know, it's because there's a couple, I think just quickly go through some of the issues with euthanasia. On the normalisation of suicide argument, that it will normalise suicide. And weirdly enough, you'd think if it didn't, then suicide numbers would fall. Because suicidal people will go for euthanasia, and no one else will. So the numbers of suicides will go down, euthanasia will go up, and they'll broadly balance. That's not really what we've seen. In fact, since 2007, the suicide rate in the Netherlands has gone up 5% a year on average.
Each year?
Up to 2013 in the paper I'm looking at the minute. Now, during that time as well, what we have seen is in 2007, 2,000 people were euthanized. In 2017, there were 6,600. In 2017, roughly 2,000 people also killed themselves in the Netherlands. The number of people who died under palliative sedation, which, for those who don't know, palliative care is kind of end-of-life care.
Sure.
Palliative sedation generally is effectively euthanasia, in that you will be put, you will be heavily sedated, and you'll generally die of dehydration. So it is effectively a way of suicide. 32,000 in 2017. A quarter of all deaths in 2017 in the Netherlands were what they term induced deaths. So suicide, euthanasia, palliative sedation. So the suicide rate went up, the euthanasia rate went up, and now a quarter of all deaths are effectively suicide.
Well, I don't mean palliative. It's suicide. I think that's it's closer to manslaughter than it is to suicide. I don't think that, generally speaking, in the case of death in palliative circumstances, very often the patient isn't involved in the discussion.
Well, I think it's so palliative sedation on its own is not euthanasia, as it is a form of pain management generally. However, if they then die of dehydration, it's either euthanasia or arguably manslaughter.
I'd like to think about that. Look at those things further to see if when you're talking about death by dehydration, is that because you're getting pain management, but you're not getting you're not being given liquids you're not being given any fluids deliberately in order to hasten death. Now, if you're on massive amounts of opiates, I am not a doctor, is that that eventually that will lead to death, but due to cardiac and respiratory failure. Anyway, I think we're talking about you're always faced here with the what is a very crude utilitarian argument dressed up as compassion, and there is, I think, if I was going to make one single point about this in the generality, it's like all of these issues, it is not about a good thing against a bad thing. It's not about a positive against a negative. We will come out of this having made the decision. That will not mean, whatever that decision is, will involve hard cases and bad outcomes. The question is, if we're going to use this kind of rule of thumb, what are the bad outcomes that we are more willing to accept?
So, I mean, are we willing to accept a situation in which? So you have a push and a pull here in relation to euthanasia. If you are elderly, and let's say your children have to look after you, your children could indicate, not in a way like, you know, into the grave with you, but in a sort of, God, you know, it must be hard for you, and, you know, it's hard to see you suffer like this, and that sort of way, that perhaps a better end could be arranged. But I would actually be more concerned about the fact that no one has to suggest that to you, because once it's an option, it becomes a choice, and
it's a choice why are you not making it?
So even if no one would ever suggest you should euthanize yourself if you're elderly and in the care of your children,
if you should arrange for the state to kill you,
you'll also know that, you know, you're making their lives worse, because they have to take time out, they have to look after you, and, you know, they say it's fine, and they, you know, they have no problem with it, and they love you, But some people are going to feel pushed into that because of that.
Absolutely. This, as I said, this will change the culture. Once you change the law, you will normalize the practice, and you'll go from normalizing the practice to creating expectation. And I think that you're right that you don't need family pressure, but I would say there will be family pressure. There will definitely be family, and it won't simply be a case of people say, oh, well,
got to get that land, Michael.
It must be hard for you and all that. You're going to have some people, nasty bad, who deliberate, who will say, now isn't it time for you to move on? Also, in patients who have no family, bed blockers, people occupying valuable space in nursing homes or in chronic care facilities, not in hospices, for example, because the hospice movement, generally speaking, is very much opposed to people who work in palliative care and end-of-life care tend to be very much opposed to euthanasia.
I suppose that's the difference between a person and a dog, Michael. If you euthanize a dog, you don't have to worry that that another dog's family is going to try and force one of those dogs to self-euthanize.
Yeah, and also, dogs, with very few exceptions, tend not to be people.
Also, they tend not to care about land deals, which in this context is really helpful.
Yeah, or the fact that mummy's using up the value of the house and the estate. God, the price of care these days, if you want a decent place, just eats up the estate, Gary.
I mean, the other thing is, you can just kill yourself. For the majority of people who want to kill themselves, you can do it. You don't need to involve the state.
Yes, this is true. People will say, well, that in some illnesses there'll come a point where it's no longer possible because you don't have the hand function anymore, you don't have the mobility, whatever. But I think that's, to be honest, as an argument, that's kind of a gruesome one. The fact is that there will be cases where people will have choices to make and will be living in situations which they would desperately, desperately not, and that's horrible. And I think we all carry within ourselves a fear of a certain kind of death. Now, I would also say, however, that part of what we need to say is not just that we shouldn't buy the line which they will sell is that this will only have good consequences. It'll be described as this wonderful, compassionate response to a difficult situation. Our society, as our societies are getting, our populations are getting older and older, and care is getting more and more difficult, and people want dignity. Dignity. There's no dignity in death. You're dead. There's no dignity. There will be very little compassion for those people in nursing homes and hospitals who are hurried along, and they will be. Or people whose families decide that it's time to give mummy a hoosh along. And sure, if it comes to it that they have to hold her down, help the doctor hold her down while getting the pillow on, well, there's a lot of dignity in that. This is the ultimate acceptance of the our rejection of the idea of the sacrality of the individual. This is, we are now being reduced to pleasure units and pain units, and there is nothing particular or sacred about the individual or the life of the individual. And that's where we are.
But anyway, I'm sure it was being talked about in the Dáil within a week of the abortion referendum passing,
yeah.
Privately, not in an actual debate.
And to know, nobody who was involved in the referendum was a bit surprised about that.
No, not at all. Our current projections, it would go through quite easily. That could be a fun referendum campaign, though.
But would it require a referendum? I'm not sure.
I don't know. I would suspect not, but at the same time, anything involving the life or death of a citizen, I could see having some constitutional implication. Also, if you do it as a referendum, it's not your fault.
Also, if we brought in abortion, and we're going to make euthanasia legal, if that's the plan, I'm struggling, and I'm not one of those people myself, but I'm struggling to see how we're going to maintain a straight face when we take a very pious position on the capital punishment.
Hmm.
You know, that everybody, but when it comes to, say, child murderers, no. Life is sacred.
On the plus side, Michael, if we bring in euthanasia and we accept the principle that people can die if they want to,
can be killed, and that the state can facilitate, be killed if they want to,
legal gladiatorial combat.
Well, yeah,
there's a benefit.
There is.
We can really just go all in on the fall of Rome feeling.
I made a proposal many moons ago for a tourist event in my local town, which would be, you know, in the Philippines they have these massive, rather gory spectacles of devotion around Easter time. Well, my suggestion was that during the year you sell tickets and you can come into the town. There's only a limited number of tickets, so the tickets are available. And every year we crucify somebody, right? Proper crucifixion, the whole thing, you know. Nobody gets down. And you sell 100,000 tickets, and the person to be crucified enters in. You sign the back of your ticket. You've entered into a contract. You take out the ticket, and it's a draw. So you have a 99,999-1 chance that it'll be you. So it's a very small chance, but enough to give you a bit of a frisson. And unless you take the chance, you can't get to see the crucifixion. I think it will be a wonderful tourist draw. All sorts of possibilities for merchandising and stuff. And under this new legislation, proposed legislation, I think we'd be able to do that. Now, I know that euthanasia might normally be seen, crucifixion, flogging and crowning of thorns might normally be the way you think of it being done. But at the end of the day, we're talking methodologies rather than principles now, aren't we?
I did have a fun conversation with someone who was supportive of this a couple of months ago. And I was saying, well, what if doctors don't want to do this? And they said, well, no doctor should have the right to decide when a patient's life should end.
Oh!
I don't know if you've thought that one true.
Right. God, doctors get very few rights these days, don't they?
But it, on one hand, it was amusing because it's obviously a ridiculous point when your argument is that doctors should be able to kill you. And mutual consent. But it kind of reminded me of the abortion debate, because there was sort of, well, what if doctors who trained when the Eighth Amendment was there don't want to have any part in abortion? What if they don't want to do this? And the general public's response of, they should be sacked, or they should quit, or they should find another area. And there's kind of a whiff of that in this as well. It's like, what if you don't want to kill one of your patients? Or what if you're okay with doing this in terms of, let's say, a terminal cancer patient, but don't think someone with a psychiatric disorder should be able to do it? Yes. Should they quit? Also the fact that we don't, you know, the health system is in collapse. We don't want to start just firing random doctors.
Yeah, it's not like we have this massive surplus of doctors that we can start fecking them out because... So why were you sacked from your job in Ireland? Well, I was against killing my patients. Okay. So you're not down with killing your patients. Is that a big thing in Ireland?
Having said that, I will. Like, I'm happy enough to accept that not keeping euthanasia illegal will lead to an increase or a continuation of suffering in certain people's lives.
That is true, but I think it's also important, while not to minimise the fact of the suffering in the individual case, that if you talk to people who work in palliative care and work in hospice care, that they are very eager that people do understand that with modern pain management techniques, the image that we have or the memories that maybe people of my age have of their childhood and how people died, that is not the case anymore. That pain management has advanced enormously. It's far more effective and far more sophisticated. And I heard, now I don't know if this is true, but doctors have said to me in this area that it is not necessary for anyone to die in pain now.
Do you know what the going rate is for euthanasia in the Netherlands? Not what you pay, but what the clinic will make.
I don't know. Can't imagine it's that much. €250?
€3,000.
Wow.
Per patient. Even if you pull out at the last minute, that will be paid to them. Here's an interesting one, though. Do you know who pays for it?
Not the Ministry for Health?
No. Health insurance companies.
Well, of course they do.
Do you think there may be a conflict of interest there, Michael? in that if you're not dead, you cost a lot of money because most of your healthcare costs are at the end of your life.
I would be very interested in seeing who's paying the lobbyists on this, actually.
The Guardian did a long read on this in the start of January of this year, and he sits down with the head of one of the clinics, and they're talking about the insurance, and the reporter says, do you think the insurance companies would prefer to pay a one-off fee rather than spending a vast sum in order to keep their, them alive? The next line is, his pained expression suggested that I had introduced a note of cynicism into a discussion that should be conducted on a more elevated plane.
Yeah, somebody like somebody thrown a dead rat into the room. Ooh, really?
The chap who heads up the clinic also then says, I strongly believe there is no need for suffering, which is just horseshit. Is as a general statement.
Yeah.
Not as an end of life statement. But anyway, look, that we did not, we actually went to 34 minutes, Michael. But still, I think we've put a pin in that for the time being. I'm sure it will now recede into the darkness where it belongs. Jeremy Corbyn.
Jeremy.
Fintan O'Toole says that Labour's failure in this election will be due to Jeremy Corbyn.
And Fintan displays his usual level of analysis and acumen in making such a horse-arse statement.
So it would definitely be Jeremy Corbyn instead of the fact that in an election entirely about the about Brexit, Labour doesn't seem to have a Brexit policy. They seem to have every Brexit policy.
Well, they seem to have settled on, I suppose, the worst of all possible cases, which is a second referendum with a touch of Remainerism. And for their voters in the Midlands and the North, that's not good enough. For people who wanted the referendum to be respected, that's good enough. But the notion is that Corbyn is the problem.
Yeah, and not the fact that Labour is saying, we will negotiate a deal, which we may or may not campaign for, and we'll have a second referendum, and if that deal is rejected, we won't leave. There will be no Brexit. Which, from a negotiating standpoint, is moronic, kind of. Because if the EU doesn't want you to leave, they'll just not give you a deal.
There are two sides to Labour's problem. Well, these things are multifaceted. But we'll take, there are two types of voter, shall we say, that Labour would try and attract and has been successful in attracting in the past or maintaining. Now, one is the traditional Labour voter in places like in the North and the Midlands of England. Now, they are the traditional generational Labour voter, and they are also Brexiteers. They want out. Now, these people are being alienated by the policy, not by Corbyn, but by the Labour Party policy, which has been decided by the party with Corbyn as leader, but in cabinet is very collective, and that's pissing them off. Now, on the other hand, because they have adopted this second bite of the cherry position, they were hopeful that they might be able to attract some of the Tory Remainer vote, particularly in the southeast, and lo and behold, then they produced their manifesto. Now, I don't know, I doubt that any human being who didn't have to will have read the thing in toto, but you'll be aware of some of their economic proposals, Gary. And famously, the 1983 Labour manifesto in England, at the time when Michael Foot, a left-wing man, and in the context of the Labour Party, a man of the left, but actually a man of huge integrity, personal courage, and great intellect, and all, and donkey jackets. This was a left-wing manifesto, and it was described at the time as being the longest suicide note in history. It was an electoral disaster. Now, this year, this version of the manifesto, of the Labour manifesto, is far, far worse. I mean, it is mind-boggling in its spending commitments. and its taxation commitments and its notions and its wrong. It's just an absolute, it's a nightmare. And to anybody who was from, any Tory that was toying with the idea of voting, shall we say, tactically for their local Labour MP to get remain from a Remainer perspective, is being frightened by the prospect of a Corbyn government. They're absolutely terrified that these people might get in and wreak absolute fucking havoc on the British economy.
But I did like the Mail Online. Their take on it was Jeremy Corbyn's £75 billion class war.
And 75 billion is part of, I mean, that's one, the numbers in this,
That's only on the housing, that's not the total cost.
No, not way for the total cost.
I have seen that people have taken the maths apart pretty comprehensively, and the problem is that it's sort of a gallop of sums that don't add up. You can spend your time going, well, this doesn't actually add up, or this one doesn't add up, or actually this is just way off. But they just keep happening, and there's no point, because you just get bogged down in, also, what about these other 40 sums?
And also, the numbers don't add up, they're also, the numbers are based on a theoretical construct which has never worked. With, you know, a policy progression which is going to go horribly wrong anyway. So the manifesto. But why is Jeremy Corbyn leader of the Labour Party? It's not, again, Corbyn is leader because this is the kind of person that the members of the Labour Party, the membership, because Labour decided.
Yes and no.
Okay.
Number
one, because certain members of the parliamentary party were stupid.
They were immensely stupid in that they hadn't, they hadn't put, you didn't have to be a member to be for a particular amount of time before you could vote on party leader.
No, but you remember that even before the party membership becomes an issue, Corbyn, the Labour Party system is that only a certain number of candidates get voted on by the wider party membership. The number is whittled down by the parliamentary party. Certain people within the parliamentary party who did not support Corbyn and wouldn't countenance him as leader voted for him on the basis, well, we should have something of a diversity of choice for the vote, you know. Knowing very well that there was absolutely no way Jeremy Corbyn could possibly win. But lo and behold, once it got down to the last bit, this is the kind of person. Yes, there was a writing campaign and people joined up. And say, for example, I don't
know. And momentum helped.
If.
Also, I know a number of Tories who.
Who joined up.
To vote, Labour Party to vote for Jeremy Corbyn because they knew he would be. He'd just implode.
I don't know. But it's saying Fianna Fáil in Ireland. I think you have to have been a member for a year and or have attended three common meetings before you get to vote in a common election. No, that's not a leadership. Any kind of party thing. You have to have attended meetings and there's a minimum requirement for a membership. Bizarrely, the Labour Party, this wonderful, ancient, sophisticated political machine, didn't. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but my sense is they didn't have that kind of rule in place. That there was no kind of attendance or duration rule for people to vote in the leader.
It is. I mean, one of the problems with the idea that Jeremy Corbyn is what will cost Labour this election is that we've had an election with Jeremy Corbyn leading Labour before, and the public didn't turn away from him. In fact, they turned kind of towards him. Third party votes collapsed.
We know from both anecdotally and pollingly that people think that Corbyn is, inverted commas, a decent guy, that he is honest, that he believes in what he says.
He gets out of 10, he got a 2.8 for likability.
Not great for likability. I imagine
not great for integrity either. Not great for competence. No, but not great across the board.
But when is this?
Last March.
Yeah. I think that if you were to look at him, Boris I imagine would score higher on likability. But I'm not sure how much higher Boris is going to score, say, on integrity.
Oh, no.
Or likability. Corbyn.
Boris Johnson won't even admit how many children he has.
I mean, does Boris...
Which is actually quite funny.
Does Boris know?
He may not.
You know, there's... This election is going to be great fun because it's about all sorts of different issues and some in different places more than others, and local issues or local voting patterns and tactical voting is going to make it. But the notion that Corbyn is the problem is a classic. You know, this is a very close relation. This story is a very close relation to that story where Venezuela is a great country. And it's a great country. It's a wonderful example of socialism until the whole thing goes belly up. And then it was never really socialist at all, you know. And that's the thing here. This is a version of, oh, well, you know, the Labour Party would have been massively elected if it wasn't for Corbyn. Because everything else, the fact that the Labour Party has come together and produced this absolute nonsense of a policy is reflective of the membership of the Labour Party. Now, and this is not unique. Political parties at the grassroots are becoming more and more detached from the voter. They are becoming more and more extreme. We know that, say, if you look at in the United States, the gap between the average Democratic voter and the positions of an activist within the Democratic Party at this stage is pretty massive.
I will say this about Fintan's article. For all that I think it's wrong, it's a pretty vicious takedown of Corbyn. And the worst takedowns always come from your friends.
Yeah.
Because it's basically just someone going, this is more than he is capable of. And that's pretty much this. All this is. It's just O'Toole saying Corbyn can't do this.
Well, you know, there's truth to that also. Corbyn has been one of those dull lights in the Labour Party for a long time. He's never shone particularly brightly. If he was, he wouldn't be clinging on so desperately to a bankrupt, exhausted theoretical system. You'd imagine if at his age, if he was. His relation... And it's almost like a cliche. It's like a character from a Tom Sharp novel, almost. The relationship with Hamas and Hezbollah, with the IRA, all of the usual anti-colonialist, anti-imperialist ticks, and the inability to see that there isn't a moral equivalence going on in these places, but there's any reasonable person should be able to spot and which way the morality lies. But because of his analytical tools, he sees it differently. He's not up to it. But on the other hand, very often, when the things about being, say, Prime Minister or President is that it's only when you become Prime Minister that people think you're Prime, that you think, oh God, yeah, actually I can see her or I can see him as Prime Minister. This is the kind of argument which is based on failure. Because you don't do it, you are never up to do it. But if you look at the last election, he actually did very well, if you're talking about vote getting.
He did, and I think the thing now is the Tories are polling ahead of Labour, but they're also polling ahead of Labour enough that complacency may set in, and you get one or two big scandals. And yeah, the vote is in 3 days, but you can do enough damage in a day to really scuttle someone.
The thing is,
I just don't think they have anything.
Well, no, and I think the Brexit thing is not going to go. That's a tactical error that they have made. And it probably, as regards Corbyn, if it was purely Corbyn's decision, Corbyn probably isn't. We see good reason to say, I suspect that Corbyn would be much happier with a straight-up Brexit strategy. The Labour hard left has always been Eurosceptic.
I know, it has been very fun seeing them have to come out and speak about the importance of Europe. Although, to be fair to Corbyn, he just refuses to say anything good about Europe.
We have had, I mean, we've had a fairly decent running comedy in Britain for a while. You had May, who was a Remainer, struggle womanfully to try and get a deal through and fail to get out. We have Boris now, who was a Brexiteer but had been a Remainer until around 20 seconds before the clock ticked down and he had to make a choice, and suddenly he jumped to Brexit. And now he's going around being all passionate about Brexit when most people suspect that in his heart, actually, Boris is stunned to find himself in the position that he's in. And then you got Jeremy, who is now campaigning on a second referendum, which is probably going to be the rock that sinks him on, even though he doesn't want to stick around for referendum at all. He just wants to get out. So it's all rich in political irony and tragedy. But it's at the end of it all, it's the economy, stupid. Theresa May won an election, and much to everyone's surprise, John Major. People looked at the blandest man imaginable, won an election that nobody expected him to win. Even Thatcher in 1979, like up against the heavyweights of Healy and Callaghan, nobody expected to win. And if she hadn't, then it would have been she would have been consigned to history. If she'd survived to a second, the people would have been writing articles about her saying she just wasn't up to it.
Yeah. There's no real heavyweights in British politics at the minute, though, are there? None under a prominent.
Heavyweights at the moment, jeepers, it's hard to...
Was it John Major who came out and said that you should vote for Labour?
Oh, God, there was going to be... Yeah, there was... I don't know.
I have really enjoyed seeing the Remainer Tories... the greatest hits of the old Tories come out and saying vote for Labour, and the Brexiteer Labour guys from the past come out and say vote for the Tories.
Well, it is, as we've said a number of times over the last little while, it looks like we're seeing a real realignment happening within British politics, which is not along the axis, the old historic axis of economic policy, but much more about social attitudes, conservatives. There's a really interesting piece of analysis of comparing the Labour voters in different places, on their attitudes just across. You know, something you've talked about before, Gary, the various quadrants. And they looked at the different voters, and if I root it out sometime, we might talk about it, but it showed the difference in two constituencies where you had one Labour vote, set of Labour voters in London, very typically cosmopolitan, ethnically diverse, quite affluent with Notting Hill kind of feel to it, you know? And I think something like 10% of them, 10-20% were socially conservative. Or would see themselves like that. In the constituency in the north, 70% were socially conservative. But and it plots something really interesting, which is there was historically a correlation, a predictive correlation between your views on the economy and your social views. In other words, the more free market you are, the more likely you are to have certain kinds of socially conservative views, or the more left-wing you are, the more marketing, the more you are likely you are to have liberal views. That's gone. That in the last 20, 30 years, not completely, but the predictive value has really declined. It's much more where you are now within the parties. So we've seen this realignment happening, and they are eating each other. And the last kicks of that old-fashioned, the old Thatcher, because one of the... And don't underestimate this. People are talking about these people as if, you know, these are the sort of the wets. One of the reasons that they are so pro-Europe is because they are part of the old internationalist free trade, free market Tories of Thatcher era. And what they see is not necessarily an issue of sovereignty, but they see this as an economic issue as well, a trade issue, and that this is a retreat into tariffs and subsidy land. And they may not be far off the mark on that. Anyway, we have a few days to go till we see the glorious result for, we imagine for Boris. Barring accidents, it seems that Boris should have it in the bag. The question is how big the bag will be. But we'll be back on Wednesday and we might talk about it then. But for the time being, I suppose we should wander back into the week and wait for the storms to come, or have the storms already come. I don't know.
All the best.
Bye-bye.